My name is Larry Rasmussen, and this is a session entitled Reagan, Meese, and the Moral Tradition of the Administration. In one of those ubiquitous post-election analyses, the Los Angeles Times carried some comments by prominent students of American history, and I'm quoting from the Times. Yale historian David Davis suggests that the election of Ronald Reagan, with his evocation of a return to the traditional American dream of abundance and greatness through 19th century frontier individualism, quote, shows that people don't want to lose that myth. It demonstrates the remarkable resilience of the myth, end of quote. Bob Delek concludes, it is no accident that Ronald Reagan was elected president at this point in our history, end of quotation. Well, the remarkable resilience of what myth? The Yale historian says the dream of abundance and greatness through individual assertion and the entrepreneurial spirit. That's part of it, I think. But there's more. Incidentally, when Davis here talks about myth, he does so as a student of society. It's not a synonym for something that is believed true but is actually false. Myth here doesn't refer to that which is fictitious and imaginary. And when I use myth in this session too, it is a reference instead to a society's popular philosophy, its presentation of what it regards as that which reality is about. So a social myth may be factually true as well as factually false, and most of them are a nice mix of facts, plausibility, and dreams. Well, my contention in this half hour that I'm going to talk and before we discuss together is that the moral notions of the Reagan administration, its notions of what are good and just and right, are illumined by one of the resilient traditional American myths, that of social Darwinism. The popular credo there is, as one pundit put it, the survival of the fiscally fittest. But that's saying too little about social Darwinism as a myth. It's much more than that, and we want to talk about that. I'll be surprised if there aren't elements of that myth which are attractive to you and which you believe in. I mentioned in the title for the session both Reagan and Meese, Edward Meese, and I do that in part just because of their formal religious practice, and it would be fun in discussion to ask if there are connections between their religious experience, habits, and the myth that I want to say defines the moral profile of the administration. Meese is, of course, Reagan's right-hand man on the White House staff, a longtime friend, close friend, an advisor, a powerful influence in the administration. He is also a very active Lutheran layperson, has been for years, and takes his Lutheranism seriously, takes his church going seriously. I was interested in talking with Paul Mons, who's been to the Village often and is a friend of the Meese family. And when one of the Meese sons graduated a couple of years ago from West Point, the Meese family wanted to do something significant at West Point for the graduation. They asked Paul Mons to come up and give an organ concert in the chapel. That was an appropriate expression of what they felt. So Edward Meese takes seriously his religious life as an active Lutheran layperson, and the rest of his family does as well. Ronald Reagan is not a churchgoer of habit. He is not informed by the confessional tradition of the Presbyterian Church that he does occasionally attend. I think it's fair to say that his religion is much more in the strain of a popular American civil religion, maybe California denomination. And we can maybe talk about that later. But there is a clear convergence and agreement of the two of them on essential moral and religious beliefs. And I'm contending that I think that's best explained not by reference to their church or non-church habits, but by reference to their social Darwinism that is a part of a creed that converges at points with what their understanding of Christianity is as well. And that's where it gets interesting in discussion. If you just want, again, to give you kind of clues where I'm coming from, another name to indicate what I'm trying to spell out is Paul Harvey. Paul Harvey, I think, is probably the most durable popular philosophers of social Darwinism. And you should know that Paul Harvey commands about the highest fees on the lecture circuit year in and year out of anyone in the country. His programs, his news programs, and his appearances across the country are continually booked, and they are the popular expression of the resilient American myth that I want to talk about. Now, I have to acknowledge that any single line of ideas, any single contention of what's going on here is going to be inadequate. So I do not mean to say that social Darwinism is a full and powerful explanatory framework for all of the morality of the administration. I do think it's a major theme, and that's what I'm contending. There is an immediate qualification that I must make about the social Darwinism I will speak of. The most important philosophy of American social Darwinism as a creed was that put forth by a Yale professor of political economy the end of the last century, William Graham Sumner. A portrait of Darwin hung in his study. I mean, everyone else at Yale had a portrait in their study of some Yale president long since forgotten, or some theologian that they didn't recognize. But Sumner had a portrait of Darwin. Incidentally, you should know that survival of the fittest is not a phrase from Darwin. It is a phrase from the social Darwinists who used Darwin's theory of evolution to explain the dynamics of society. Well, Sumner had his Darwin portrait there on the wall of his study, and he taught political economy. But Sumner's was, in Richard Hofstadter's phrase, social Darwinism of the hard-bitten sort. Reagan's, I will contend, is social Darwinism that is more soft-bitten. Sumner was concerned that we face up to the hardness of life, to the impossibility of finding easy solutions for human ills, to the necessity of labor and self-denial, and to the inevitability of suffering. There was, for Sumner, a kind of naturalistic Calvinism that is at quite some distance from Reagan's soft-bitten California social Darwinism. And in California, as you know, there's no Calvinism of any sort, naturalistic or otherwise. So Reagan's is a little different than Sumner's, and we'll get into that a bit. But on many strands, Sumner and Meath and Reagan will agree, especially in the proper societal arrangements that are necessary for developing good moral character. And it's that concern with character. Character and conduct are the two chief concerns for morality. It's that concern for character that we begin the profile of the Reagan administration's morality and the talk about the moral tradition out of which it comes. When the president talked to an audience of black Republicans in Washington in mid-September of last year, he said, in part, "With the coming of the Great Society," meaning the Johnson administration primarily, "government began eating away at the underpinnings of the private enterprise system. The big taxers and big spenders in Congress had started a binge that would slowly change the nature of our society and, even worse, threaten the character of our people." End of quotation. Now, when the president talks about changing the nature of our society and the character of our people, the ears of your basic citizen may pick up a bit. But for people like myself with responsibility for teaching ethics, my ears start to tingle, and then they sort of start to buzz a little bit, and then they start to itch. I want to know what he's talking about, since the character of people and the nature of society is what I must professionally attend to. And I start listening to the president with more absorption than the joggers in my neighborhood do to their Sony Walkman. But when Ronald Reagan talks like that, what does he mean? And what kind of cultural resonance does he get in our society? What does it say about the nature of our society and our own nature? Those are questions of moral analysis. Now, I want to pass along, then, what I think he means when he talks like that. Let's do it by focusing on the administration's proposals that you're familiar with. And I just want to assert what I think those proposals are about. Cuts in government spending are advocated not, first of all, I think, in this administration, because they may not be affordable in strict economic terms, but even more because they are, in its view, socially corrosive. Corrosive of our character. They destroy discipline, that is, high government spending. They make of us a flaccid and placid and irresponsible folk. What they do is rob us, in the administration's view, of the very struggles that make for human fulfillment. Reaganomics is less economics at its roots than it is a certain economic morality and social myth. What is that social myth? It's not conservatism in the classic sense. It's not a conservatism that has been articulated in American history by, say, Alexander Hamilton in kind of classic fashion, or in Anglo-Saxon traditions, the conservatism of someone like Edmund Burke. That kind of, or in nowadays, if you read George Will as a syndicated columnist, it's not George Will's conservatism either. That kind of classic conservatism has a very deep sense of the organic character of society. The organic society requires the slow upbuilding of good public character on the basis of the tested values of the past, especially public values. But Reagan's conservatism, and I put it in quotation marks, has nothing of that sense of social bonding, where the whole society is organic in character. Nor does it have classic conservatism's notion of the deep iniquity in the human soul that requires that you always take all due care not to tear the social fabric in the process of reforming or repairing it. Reagan is only the most, and Mies with him, the most distant cousin of classic conservatism, and is instead in the tradition of social Darwinism. Now, what does that look like? The best place to enter there is social Darwinism's picture of the marketplace and the place of government in our lives. Social Darwinism contends that the marketplace is the primary field for the development of personal character. It's work that provides people with moral discipline, and just that moral discipline is required for survival. Life, Herbert Spencer, who was the basic philosopher, formulator of social Darwinism before Sumner, life, Spencer said, again and again, is a competitive struggle in which only those with the strongest moral fiber survive. However, it is through the competitive struggle, above all in the marketplace, that societies, persons, and then societies themselves become stronger. The fittest prosper because only they are the ones that have mustered the necessary resources to sustain themselves and their offspring. In this picture of life, even poverty plays a positive role in the struggle. I forgot to put on the board George Gilder's book, Wealth and Poverty. That book was handed out by David Stockman like pencils on the street corner when it came out, and Mies and Reagan both endorsed it publicly and said this is a profound influence on our policies in this administration. George Gilder's book is the new statement of social Darwinism. In that book, George Gilder contends, quote, "The poor need the spur of their own poverty." He means by that what Reagan means, that humble material beginnings and being in a position where you have to work places a premium upon creativity, intelligence, skill, and self-control, and that these are the engines of progress. So that impoverishment also plays its role, then, in this social progress. Well, it's a simple correlate of that government should do little or nothing to eliminate poverty in any direct way. What it should do is get rid of the debris that keeps clogging the works of the free enterprise system so that the market will develop strong personal and public character. It should do that which will release the energies that swell when people have to work and have to adapt in order to get along. Government should certainly not encourage those habits of character that make for dependency relationships, whether that's untied aid to poor nations or bigger checks if you have more babies on welfare or the like. Do not promote dependency relationships. The law of natural selection of the stronger means hands off the corporation as well. Hard-won success is what is to be encouraged, and the result is the weeding out of weaker companies that don't get their creativity, intelligence, discipline, and skill together. And this happens then in the rough and tumble of an open market. The economy and the public good will be the better for it. Now, there's an ambivalence that's here about the relationship of government and large business corporations. But I think even the ambivalence is best explained by social Darwinism. One side of the ambivalence goes like this. Government may have to restrain even large corporations if it perceives their behavior to be running against the national self-interest in international competition. National survival is ensured by national strength. And survival is an especially bitter contest in the international arena. If we are not the fittest, we will not prevail against those who ardently aspire to be the fittest, like the Soviets. This is the way the line goes. Thus, there is one sector where government is to play a massive role while it gets out of all the rest, and that is in national defense. Thus you have, on the one hand, on the basis of social Darwinism, the creed, get the government off our backs, it's better for everybody, and on the other hand, an enormous boost in the defense budget. It's because of the same competitive struggle, but now the nation is the focus in the international arena. And sometimes that means government intervention in international free trade, such free trade otherwise favored by social Darwinists. That's the case when the intervention is perceived as critical to national survival. So you have the government, Reagan, favoring and in trying to impose pipeline embargoes, including on big American corporations, against the Soviets, at the same time that Reagan tells the poorer nations in Cancun that an unregulated private sector is the best engine of development. Now, the other side of the ambivalence about the corporations is that the government might try to aid corporations and not restrain them. If the same issue is at stake, namely national strength as national fitness in an internationally competitive situation. So there's ambivalence there. Domestically, however, you favor anti-regulation and the open movement of labor and capital, free trade. Internationally, it may be that sometimes, it may not be that other times, but it's because of the same concern in social Darwinism about the survival of the fittest, and here the focus is on the nation as the unit. Okay, some other areas that I think try to sort of outline the morality here. Prayer in the public schools is favored, I think in part because it's the conviction of the administration that it builds moral rectitude and reverence in the young. Reagan, I have never heard him argue theologically about which God is to be prayed to. I don't think that's important, because the purpose of prayer in the school is what it does for the character of the kids. Does it promote discipline? Does it promote respect, etc.? These are all sort of virtues that are to be promoted. Proscriptions on abortions make people more responsible for their actions by not withholding the consequences of those actions. Possessing firearms means people can defend themselves and thus yet in another way take more control of their lives, and that's a good thing. A balanced budget, which is now a real myth in the sense of fictitious of the administration, a balanced budget forces the hard choices that both good character and fiscal survival require. All of these things mean that we will be morally stronger, and that is good. Okay, I want to take a few minutes to flesh this out a bit by talking about some of the origins of social Darwinism in American life. I mentioned Herbert Spencer. Herbert Spencer, to my knowledge, never set foot on these shores, nor did Charles Darwin, for that matter. Herbert Spencer was a civil engineer in England, and he expounded a philosophy on the basis of Darwin, but it was just about perfect that you got a civil engineer together with Darwin's philosophy of evolution at the time that you did, the late 19th century. That was a time of fantastic American industrial expansion. And so, as Richard Hofstadter says, I put this book on the board, Hofstadter, Social Darwinism and American Thought. Spencer's was a system conceived in and dedicated to an age of steel and steam engines, competition, exploitation, and struggle. That was the ethos of the day. A famous preacher, the most famous probably in 19th century America, Henry Ward Beecher, wrote to Herbert Spencer in 1866, "The peculiar condition of American society has made your writings far more fruitful and quickening here than in Europe." In other words, there is a match between the social Darwinism of Spencer and late 19th century American life on an industrializing society and an expanding frontier. Lots of room. Folks coming into the country, immigrants with coming from industrial societies, carrying all kinds of skills with them, enormous resources out there, the move westward, etc. Now, Spencer's is also social Darwinism of the hard-bitten sort, and I want to share a little bit of Spencer with you and to show you the tradition out of which I think Mies and Reagan come. It's not their soft brand, you will hear. Spencer was convinced that you had a cosmic plan at work, that God is sanctioning this. It's a weeding out of inferior specimens in order to produce cumulatively a better race of people and a better society. There mustn't be any misguided interference in this plan. Sympathy for the weak and the suffering has to be restrained from any excess which might lead a person to take on what the suffering and the weak ought to be doing for themselves. Spencer's favorite illustration was that in order to learn how to swim, you've just simply got to swim. Someone can't just tell you or swim for you. You've got to be tossed into the water and make your own way. And it's wrong if a strong swimmer comes and swims for you. Now, from this kind of perspective, Spencer could only look with dismay upon every attempt of society to assist individuals or protect them, no matter what their situation. So Spencer made a long list of the things that the state or the government should not do. Regulate industry, impose tariffs, should not grant subsidies, favor churches, supervise professions, establish colonies, maintain schools, and you might find it curious, build and operate lighthouses. That's on his list as well. But above all, it must not assist the poor, improve sanitation, or administer public health programs. Now, why should these things be prohibited? Survival of the fittest. That was his phrase, and these are his words. The poverty of the incapable, the distresses that come upon the imprudent, the starvation of the idle, and the shouldering aside of the weak by the strong are the decrees of a large, far-seeing benevolence. The same kindly dispensation that brings to early graves the children of diseased parents and singles out the debilitated as the victims of an epidemic. Under the natural order of things, society is constantly excreting its unhealthy, imbecile, slow, vacillating, faithless members to leave more room for the strong and the deserving. End of quotation. You see why I call that a hard-bitten social Darwinism. The way in which that's talked about today outside of human society is the way in which one hears oftentimes the praises of the non-human environment, where we say the predators are doing everybody a favor by getting the weak or the young or the lame or the diseased animals and eating them. It's the same notion of evolution for a greater good. So any impulse of the fit to prolong the lives of the unfit is misguided. It frustrates the cosmic plan, Spencer said, in three ways. It keeps the unfit alive, it diverts the fit from their proper task of self-realization and propagation of their own kind, and it increases the number of marginal people who might otherwise be scared into some self-redeeming efforts. Now, Spencer would not probably have gained much currency had not Darwin's scientific theory come along at the time, and had not you had a continent with room to expand and great energy and great skills and resources that we had at that moment in the Industrial Revolution as it came to these shores. Nor probably would Spencer have gained much currency had it not been for William Graham Sumner, the professor at Yale that I mentioned, who worked there until his death in 1910. What Sumner did was construct a synthesis that brought together three leading traditions in Western capitalist culture. And these three traditions are the ones that combine in much of American life, and I think in Mies and Reagan. One, the Protestant ethic, but secularized as a work ethic. The work ethic, this Yankee work ethic, is not the same as a Protestant ethic, but it is a version of that. Two, the doctrines of classical economics, interpreted as laissez-faire or hands-off individualism and entrepreneurship. And three, a notion of a kind of natural selection of the stronger in society. That's the Darwinian natural selection. And although Sumner had been ordained as an Episcopalian priest, the decisive event in his life was the discovery of Spencer, which led him to get rid of his Christian supernaturalism and take on the Calvinistic naturalism, the evolutionary naturalism that I spoke above earlier, which stresses the necessity of struggle against an unreasoning and brutal world. Progress, Spencer thought, happens when you have fruitful technological innovation that make it possible to exploit nature's resources more effectively. This, in turn, will produce beneficial adjustments in social and economic circumstances. But that faith in technology will not happen if the social balances are disrupted and government plays too heavy a role. If, for example, the state intervenes in economic processes. Political action should not be directed then, Spencer insisted, against industry. That'll result in weakening initiative, hindering progress, and so on. In his view, the major peril of the times was the zeal of politicians and reformers to interfere in economic affairs, something that he branded, quote, the absurd attempt to make the world over, end of quotation. The only legitimate function of the state was to stabilize the existing industrial system and protect the rights of individuals in relation to it and maximize the possibilities of their choice and activity in a free marketplace. Whenever a democratic majority uses political power to intervene in the economic order, Spencer said, the results are always bad. In fact, he thought that one of the most notable achievements of American democracy was the separation of church and state, so that you didn't intrude some sentimental morality that the churches might be favoring into the competitive struggle in the economic order. Let me finish here with asking why Spencer and Sumner's ideas have had a lasting life in American history. I think it's that Spencer's version of inevitable progress through an entrepreneurial spirit in a setting of abundance and with a faith in technological progress fell in with the general optimism of American life. And Ronald Reagan is the picture of both American optimism and American innocence. This reinforced the self-confident views of a people who had won their own independence against a great national, international power, Britain, who had stamped out the scourge of slavery, finally, who had spread their civilization from sea to shining sea across a broad continent. And when, at the close of the century, the United States began to acquire itself an empire and professors and poets and politicians, they found it easy to invoke the Spencerian formulas about the survival of the fittest in order to justify the advance of American hegemony over lesser breeds. It was at the point of self-discipline for the purposes of fulfilling destiny. I should have gotten the tape that we have in our tape library. It's interviews with prominent Americans about their picture of America. There's an interview in there with Ronald Reagan. And he talks about the special place that America has in the divine, in God's plan. It holds a special mission in the world. Well, here you combine self-discipline in a struggling world in a way that fulfills the nation's own conception of its destiny. And at the same time, you're fitting in with something which is kind of a cosmic plan. This is the way reality is to go. In that way, social Darwinism and the cultural tradition of much Protestantism reinforced each other. And that's why I think Mises' Lutheranism, his understanding of it, and his Americanism find convergence. The prevailing ethical climate of the United States in the last half of the last century accommodated what was then a kind of reductionist Protestantism and Darwinism, where the Protestant ethic taught people to self-denial, discipline, frugality, in order to lay up their riches for the glory of God. Social Darwinism told them to do the same thing in order to fulfill themselves in a competitive struggle for the improvement of the society as a whole. Both presented self-concern and self-advancement as goods that would result in the overall progress of the society, and in the language of those days, of the race. So that Sumner and Spencer, using Darwin, provided a popularized philosophy that in effect ratified the American experiment. Now, finishing then with where we started. Why did Davis at Yale think that it's no coincidence that Reagan was elected at this point in American history? I think it's because social Darwinism has its greatest appeal whenever people sense the terms are those of survival. It is an American myth in which the way to survive is the focus and is simultaneously the way to prosperity and the good life. When you have prosperity, let me put it differently. Social Darwinism joins survivalist struggles with optimism and confidence. It's theodicy, it's explanation of the evil in the world. It's theodicy powerfully justifies the temporary sorrows of the marketplace. When you have prosperity going along in a society, but without fears of survival, then the appeal of social Darwinism lessens. Then the generosity of liberalism in an expanding economy can command the heights. And so the 50s and the reign of Eisenhower the Good. Or the soaring 60s into the Great Society. That was a time of expanding prosperity without fears of survival. And that's when liberalism has its appeal and Darwinism recedes. But when the downturn comes, or at least a perception of the loss of American power across many fronts, economic and in the world political order, then this kind of encoded social Darwinism in our cultural genes manifests its otherwise only latent traits. And I think the challenge for the political left now is not to focus only, although it's important, on alternative policies and programs, but it is to enunciate an ideology or a myth that is appropriate to an era haunted by fears of survival. Okay, that's just an effort to sketch a little bit of where social Darwinism came from and a little bit of why I think it has appeal now, and also to, I hope, give you something recognizable in the administration's moral profile. Let's discuss. Yeah, Norm?
Would you say a couple more sentences after your last about where the political left should go? Where would that lead?
Let me come at that. I mean, I think that is the question. What is that alternative ideology? I mean, where do we go from here if you do not concur with the administration's ordering of things? I have to kind of back into that by saying that to me, the thing I don't like about the administration presently is not simply disagreement about the economy, although I don't particularly like that either. I think the most pernicious effect that the administration might have is to destroy public faith in the compatibility of prosperity and compassionate social policy. That one cannot have effective government that the government can be a place that can be the source of compassionate social policy. Now, I think the political left has to somehow say one can combine economic recovery, prosperity, and compassionate social policy. So it's articulating that direction, it seems to me, that one has to go. And of course that comes down to some programs, and thus there's a lot of talk now about the reindustrializing of American economic life that does involve much more planning by groups affected, not just centralized groups affected, but communities. So you just don't simply have a free movement of labor and capital so that when a steel plant closes down in western Pennsylvania, that tough. We shouldn't be involved in that kind of thing. So I think the general direction has to be an ideology that makes that combination of compassionate social policy publicly decided upon and prosperity.
In what ways is Lutheran theology compatible or incompatible with social Darwinism? Does it meet consonant with his heritage in that regard?
Well, I think that the line of development there is a line that in fact does move from the Protestant ethic which came out of the Reformation. And it's stronger in Calvin than in Lutheran, but it's surely there as well. In Calvin you have the Protestant ethic formulated as self-denial, discipline, frugality, life as a struggle, in which one, in one's place of work, in one's public life, does these things to the glory of God, who is the judge. If prosperity issues from your self-denial, your hard work, your frugality, then that is an indication of God's blessing. For Calvin, if it did not issue in that, and it often would not, you might die poor, but you should still live that way, you can nevertheless be assured that God will reward you on the other side of death. That is also in American Lutheranism a strong strain. It has, however, come through a Yankee secularization of the work ethic. We have kept in one strain the self, the necessity for discipline, hard work, viewing life as a struggle. We've completely chucked the frugality. That's not there. And that is the turn also, as I mentioned, of social Darwinism, that now one can do this for one's own upbuilding of character and the social good. I think that Mises' morality is reinforced by his, I think it's Missouri Synod, Lutheran connections, via the Yankee version of the Protestant ethic. So I think that's part of it. There is that kind of connection. If you're asking a normative question, that is, how would you assess that in light of Lutheran theology and ethics, then we've got another discussion. I was just trying to give what I think is a...
Well, how would you judge Mises? Is he deluded his vision of the kingdom then? Is he fallen victim to the Yankee spirit?
Now you've only asked the question of Lutheran
Lutheranism in the United States. I mean, that's a big topic. What are your hunches there?
Oh, I know very little about Meeks.
Yeah. Well, I don't know a whole lot. I mean, I've heard him talk on occasions. He's been very receptive when people from the LACUSA offices in Washington want to meet with the administration on issues that the administration is facing. And so I hear from those folks on his response and so on.
I myself am really very confused by this whole thing and wonder if we're really dealing with a difference in manner of going about doing something. If we start from an objective of do we want to take care of people, or are we just talking about nationalism, then I'm going to look at Reagan. Is he talking, we're just going to worry about the nation, we won't care about individuals, or is there a concern for individuals as well? And if there's a concern for individuals, is he talking about simply a different approach to concern? Is he saying then that the way to take care of the individual is to make that person less dependent upon government? So we're not necessarily talking about a lack of concern for people.
No, I think Ronald Reagan and we're all expressing speculative judgments. I think Ronald Reagan is genuinely concerned about people. I think that he believes that concern manifests itself by the proper social arrangements so that a certain setting is there that will result overall in that which is best.
I think that's important for people to keep in mind.
Yeah.
Because one of the things he said, and whether he's doing it or not, I'm not quite entirely sure, is to get the federal government out and let states take over, as well as individuals take over. And you hear a lot of complaining about the federal government withdrawing, but you don't see any action towards states taking over, which is the other half of what he says he's trying to do. And the people say he's not for people, but that may not be the case. It's a different approach.
My preference would be to judge the arrangements that he's proposing and the consequences of those for people, and to make the judgment there rather than make the judgment at the point of whether or not he cares as an individual for other individuals. Yeah. Judy, and then Alan.
If you take an issue such as the cutbacks in food stamps,
yeah,
it always seems to me that that particular thing works against social Darwinism as you've just described it. In other words, a person who is able to work, to be in the marketplace, I'm talking about some, poor person X, who is able to maintain him or herself in the marketplace, to go out to work every day, and struggle and do these good things, whose food stamps are cut, may not be able to continue doing that and only become more dependent by having to back down to the level of surviving on welfare as opposed to going out. And that seems to be, that's just a real practical example of that. Where is the strengthening, kind of thing by participating in the struggle of the marketplace that particular kind of cutback in government gives to the people?
Yeah, that has been pointed out, and if the Reagan administration is consistent, if you demonstrated that people were actually placed on welfare as a consequence of such cuts, I think they would have to say, we've got to do something different.
It's defeating itself, that ideal.
Yeah. I think the question is there is one of whether that's happening and if and whether.
Well, I don't know for sure that it is happening, but I hear that it is, and I suspect that it must be, because I personally have known people who are marginally employed, for whom food stamps is a very important source of, of allowing them to work and have the dignity of participating in this economic struggle in the marketplace, and with that help withdrawn, they're brought back to a lower level of this struggle in the Darwinian, circuit.
Yeah. Alan?
I get the feeling that what you're saying, that his moral kind of attrition is the kind of government parental tough love approach in terms of dealing with individuals, somewhat like we see in the tough love approach of parents and the family constellation. How does that tradition approach or articulate the concept of justice? What is justice in that frame of reference? Is there a concept, and how does it fit in, or what is it? What is justice?
There are a couple of different traditions of justice in American society, and just to make it very brief, one is justice as liberty, where that society is just, which maximizes the choices that people have in all areas of life and guarantees the least amount of interference or blocking of those choices. So maximizing choices for individual that is commensurate with other people's ability to do the same is a notion of justice. Justice is liberty. Another notion of justice in American life is justice as equality, which you have some notion of kind of a comparative allotment that everybody gets so that you have a minimally humane existence for all as a kind of starting point. And lots of our debates and policies and administrations go and come which try to work with justice as liberty, in tension with justice as equality, and which of them is to dominate. And how does one compensate for the negative consequences of going with the other one? In the Reagan administration, I think the strong emphasis is on a notion of justice as liberty. And that a conviction that the society as a whole will be the better if that wins out. Or in economic terms, you always have a tension between efficiency and equity. That which is the most efficient economically often draws lines stronger or more distance between the haves and the have-nots, at least for a period of time. Whereas equity tends to guarantee something to everybody, but at some cost to efficiency. And in that debate, the Reagan administration favors efficiency over equity and is convinced that that will also redound to the greater good given limited choices. We're not talking about an ideal society, we're talking about that over against alternatives. Doesn't like the alternatives. So I think it's justice defined as liberty combined with a strong emphasis on economic efficiency as a defined classical economics.
So there tends to be a correlation then between that function of justice and what you talked about previously in terms of in good times of progress, the one equity can have an does have an opportunity to at least be less efficient, but also then to look at and focus on equity. In tough times, efficiency tends to be the sort of justice that tends mm-hmm. to want to drain.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Where does a strong anti-communism fit into this whole business? Is that the liberty?
Well, no. I don't know. Someone else needs to help me there. I don't know Reagan's personal history well enough. I do know that it's been there for decades. I don't know if there's personal experience there, as there have been for some of that generation. For example, Hubert Humphrey, a liberal Democrat, was strongly anti-communist because of his experiences with the Communist Workers and Party in this country, even in Minnesota. I don't know if there's Reagan's personal experiences out there, or if it's part of much of a kind of American anti-communism out of the experience of post-World War II and And certainly, Reagan has always been an ardent capitalist, so you have that ideological conflict with communism. It isn't as such. Well, let me put it this way. If he is, as I contend, a social Darwinist, you can see where communism doesn't fit into that. The justice as equality, the economics as emphasis upon equity, and a planned economy rather than the free marketplace. Those are just at odds. But I can't give you the details. It's certainly there. My, we haven't had a president in a long while that's been this convinced that the Soviet Union is the focal point of all evil, to use his own phrase. And it's reinforced in the social Darwinist schema in the international scene because of what I mentioned. National survival is played out in an internationally competitive situation. But in the social Darwinist scheme, that wouldn't only apply only to communist states, but to anyone that sought to be on top.
Seems to me that he had a struggle with communists in the Actors Guild.
Right.
Oh, you're right. That's right. There was.
He was one of the staunch defenders of our way of things when there was that McCarthy persecution.
Yeah.
McCarthy is persecution of actors.
I'm glad you brought that up. That personal chapter is there. And I think it would be interesting sometime, and I don't know if Mark Twain is around or not, who does American Studies at Chicago, just to look at that generation and those encounters with socialist and communist movements in this country. And Ronald Reagan will tell you, every time someone says he's anti-union, he'll tell you that he's a union man and helped organize the Actors Guild, and that's where those struggles took place. You're right.
John Wayne and all those guys who are on the opposite side.
Yeah.
I guess I have a hard time understanding how our administration can think the plan will work if we're really take the Global 2000 report seriously, thinking that there may not be the resources to do all these wonderful things with, and then where are we?
Mm-hmm.
Two things. Quickly, if again the social Darwinist schema has explanatory power, it, number one, has a very strong confidence that resources are created. I mean, oil was absolutely useless until the particular technology came along. Something else, some other materials out there that we have that we aren't using for something now, will become resources if you have an innovative technology, and that requires a certain planning. So there's a basic disagreement on whether resources are limited or not.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, you should know, if you don't already, that the administration has appointed a commission which has issued a report which refutes
mm-hmm.
Carter's Global 2000 Presidential Commission report. It says it's just plain wrong, and it's wrong by talk of limits. They are not present in the way that the Global 2000 report says they are, and will not likely be. So there's just fundamental disagreement. They're not going to take it seriously. They don't agree with it.
But it strikes me that part of the argument is that opportunity must be there. I mean, we all have the opportunity to go out there and work hard and improve ourselves and save our money and amass capital and become wealthy, but I don't think the opportunity is there for everybody. I mean, I don't think the kid from Harlem really has that good of an opportunity.
Yeah, that of course is a major and continuing criticism of the Reagan administration, especially by groups that are in settings where the choices are very limited. I mean, thus you can't find.
But would that be their argument? Is those people are poor because they simply lack the ambition and motivation to get out there and get their share of the goodies?
Well, Let's hear from others on that kind of thing. Yeah.
Sure, much more to that, but it seems like then we're able to see some of these policies affecting handicap programs and disabled programs, people who are on SSI that are being cut off in recent months recent years have been.
Yeah, I must add this, and I neglected to say it in the course of things, and it's very important to understanding Reagan and Mises' morality here. Such assistance for the handicapped, or providing more opportunity where the choices are limited because the environment is so constraining, there is a call on the part of those who are stronger not to interfere and do those things for them, but to assist in ways which make for self-reliance on the part of those people. And thus, a very strong call for volunteerism, for local groups addressing local problems, as long as you don't create genuine dependency relationships, so that it is in fact a moral obligation on my part to get in there and help solve problems locally if I do it in a way that enhances opportunity, etc. That's important to say that, because it isn't that the handicapped ought not to be helped, it's that government ought not be the agency to do so. Rather, other individuals who have attained something have an obligation to get in there and help others out of dependency relationships or enhance choices or whatever. Yeah. Did the bell ring or not?
No.
Okay.
I wondered if there is a sense in which, as we look at things, that how we are swayed in many of those social programs, there have been, and this is what you see in the paper, some who take tremendous advantages. You read about somebody who's drawing aid to dependent mothers from six sources or something, and driving a big car and the whole thing. People get the feeling that these programs are way out of whack.
Yes.
And need to be knocked down again.
Yes.
And then after a while we say, well, this isn't really working. There are all these poor kids down here that are getting no help at all. And you see it swaying the other way again. Mm-hmm. Even in, I can think of an individual who told me, and I happen to be in my background, my father's school superintendent, my brother is, there are now four fellows handling the job he once had.
Mm.
And we keep building up all these things, and then we get the feeling we've got to cut out all this and we've got to knock it down. And then we sway to the other direction after we see that, because none of them seem to work.
Yeah. I think I have to go pray. When the bell rings, I have to be up there. But thank you
for your.